Okay, so I'd like to start out with talking about homework two, which was due yesterday, but a lot of people, again, seem to be taking advantage of the late policy. I didn't think it would require that, but okay. I looked at some of the sample of some of the submissions, and there's a common error I would like to give you an opportunity to fix if you've made, including if you've already submitted without penalty. And that's sometimes some of these questions ask you to estimate some performance gained or performance lost. So C3 says estimate performance gained. I want a quantity. I do not want something qualitative. And this comes up in this question where you should give me a range of numbers of like seconds or something like that. And the same thing is true for part D. I want to ask you, what's the benefit of correct branch prediction? I want you to give me an estimate of how much is the performance probably helped because of how high the branch prediction rate is. I don't want you to tell me that, yes, it's definitely helped, because I know that. Like, it's not going to be any other way. And some people gave me their experimental results from which they could come up with a guess, but didn't give me a quantitative number. So if you have questions like this where I asked you for an estimate of the effect of something, on the performance, I want you to give me like a range of numbers or something like that, or an approximate number. And you can make some wild assumptions in that, because I'm not actually telling you to test all the scenarios here and modify the simulator to do everything that we might hypothetically want to do. But, please actually come up with a number. It's really disappointing to see someone who actually run the experiment and didn't get the final result. And another issue is when I ask about performance in general, you probably should be using program performance, like runtime. Don't avoid using things like, say, number of instructions executed per cycle, because some of those instructions are mispredicted branches and things like that. And so you'll get some very deceptive view. But the big thing is, if you've made this mistake where you didn't give me a number for this question or this question, a percentage, please go ahead and fix that. I don't really want you to see things where you have all the numbers you need to compute it in a file and you didn't understand that that's what I was looking for, and not sort of performance will change a lot or a little sort of estimate. Yeah. And if you have any questions on this, feel free to ask me after class, or on Piazza, or something like that. And I would like to know what was surprising about the homework, which makes it be late for so many people. I was hoping it was a little more obvious than homework one, how much work you'd have to do. So with that out of the way, let's move on to today's topic, which is going to be talking about the Cray one. Yeah, sorry.
So, give us the time to correct it. You mean midnight tonight? Or?
Next couple days. So, if you made that mistake where you just said, having cache misses overlap really helps performance, which some people did, and I understand maybe you could interpret estimate how overlapping cache misses help, changes performance that way. But I was looking for like a number estimate. So if you made that mistake, resubmit in the next couple days and just leave me a note that you did that. And that's fine, I won't take off points. I want you to actually try to answer the real question and not answer it just because you misunderstood what I was looking for. Though I think it was clear, but it's not a good reason that I want to be giving you less credit for something. Okay, so first, a review of what we were talking about last time. So last time we talked about transactional memory. And we saw these, and I have a little point I want to add on, which we didn't get to last time. So we saw that the modern ideas for transactional memory had this interface where instead of having these load transactional, store transactional, etc., you started the transaction and they hid all side effects from you. And that avoided the problem of the validate instruction that the original proposal had, where you need to remember to do that before you use something you got from load transactional. And you can look at transactional memory from that perspective as another form of speculation. So branch prediction, that's speculation. Well, transactional memory is just more generalized speculation. And we saw also speculation in, for example, doing loads and stores out of order. So it's a general way to support it. And there are more opportunities for speculation. And one place people want to do speculation sometimes is like operating systems. So people have proposed, for example, having operating systems speculate a cached copy of a file is up to date. And one thing that some of these transactional memory mechanisms have tried to do is maybe look at supporting letting operating systems and other software do that sort of speculation more easily. So I mentioned that, so to realize that there's more applications for transactional memory than just the obvious sort of synchronization, that it gives us a mechanism to do things that might be useful in other contexts, where even if you don't have another thread, you can run something and then decide whether or not to commit a report, rather than doing that manually and keeping a log of what you're doing yourself. Okay, so any questions about the topic from last time, transactional memory? Lingering thoughts? Yeah?
Sure, so for the issue with transactional memory working poorly with non-item potent instructions, what's the way around that? Suppose you do that from item potent thing.
So you need actual exclusion, right? The classic example of a nine-item potent operation is like printing a page on a printer. And if you're printing a page on a printer, there's no way around it. You need actual locks. You need exclusion. So for some things, you really need exclusion. Now, there's some things which aren't item potent, which maybe we could make be undoable. So for example, sending something to another process or another machine is something that is not idempotent. But we could imagine that if we had the cooperation of that other process, we could make it work safely with transactions. But this is more of an operating systems topic. So that's where the fixes for that would come. Right? But for the most part, like a lot of these things, you just are things you actually can't undo. And you actually can't use transactions for. Other comments, questions? Okay. So for today, we looked at two papers. And no one remarked that it was weird that we were reading them together, so that's good. And I collected some common questions from the paper reviews. And the biggest and most surprising to me is that the paper about vector processing engines used this term swizzling, which no one knew what it meant. And it's not actually a very complicated thing, which is why I didn't try to explain it before. So swizzling is just a name for rearranging vectors. So that example didn't form it. So just reordering things in a vector. So you have x, y, z, w, just changing the order of that, possibly duplicating things. So getting x, y, z, w into, say, any of these configurations is swizzling. That's all it means, and it just happens to be handy for graphics. And a lot of the features in that vector engine were really designed to run graphics stuff, and not with general purpose computation in mind. They're not features you would put in a normal CPU. And by supporting swizzling, you know, this was their syntax, where the vector is naturally XYZW, but you could specify different orderings of it in the instruction, and that was supported as part of every single instruction in the vector engine, including finding cases like broadcast a value across the vector. And they also had, similar to that, write mask, where you could specify that an instruction doesn't modify certain parts of a vector, even though the computation unit can always do four things at once. So that was probably the biggest thing, biggest sort of confused point of confusion. And I hope hopefully that's out of the way. So it's not actually a complicated thing. But yeah, they assume people in graphics know what it is. And we didn't. So the other big question was, this Cray 1, you know, got claimed that vectors were faster. You know, a lot faster, in fact. And they had like one adder and one multiplier. So where was that speed up? Where was that extra speed they were getting actually coming from? So anyone have a guess or an idea about where we should look to figure out why it was so much faster?
So the only thing I can think of was they talk about how much smaller a vector can be to still achieve the benefit of the vector. So the actual overhead of using them is low.
Mm-hmm.
And if the overhead of using them is low enough, then there's more code that you would want to vectorize, potentially.
Okay.
So you don't need 1,000 things to make it work. But they didn't really discuss that.
Yeah, so their machine had one adder, had like a single adder used for the vector operations, basically, and a single multiplier. So why was running vector operations faster if you only have one place you're actually doing, say, multiplying two vectors together? One place you're just putting each element, and it only takes like one element at a time. Where did this speed come from? So there was a concept that people brought up, which was mentioned in the paper, which was startup times. So there's this notion that to start doing a vector operation, you needed to wait a while to get the first result. And then after that, you just kept getting results over and over again. So do we have this sort of problem in, say, a modern superscalar processor? Do you have to worry about the startup time of your add instruction? No. Why do you think that? Mm-hmm. So the adds here are three cycles, but let's look at their performance chart. So these are operations which involve probably a bunch of adds, multiplies, things like that. And here's their performance. So this is just increasing the number of elements you're operating on. So where's the benefit between going from like 10 to 60? Why is it you get higher throughput? If it turns out, and note that, so one option would be that maybe you just have more things that can do these calculations. Maybe you have more things which can do multiplications and additions. But it turns out that, you know, there's not more than 10 of those. So where's the benefit coming from? Anyone remember something from the paper? Yeah.
Well, the more elements that you can, the more work you're doing in the vector processors, the more you're hiding the latency of starting up the whole computation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the latency becomes small compared to the
Yeah, so this is all about latency hiding. And we've seen lots of techniques for latency hiding over the semester. So how do out-of-order processors hide the latency of the operations?
I guess, well, one operation is doing something, you can run some other ones instead.
Yeah, so they overlap the operations. And that's something that the Cray paper talks about. What remember the name chaining? Chaining is overlapping operations. So that's something they do. So this is doing it specifically for the case of vector operations. So does chaining differ from how we overlap instructions in our superscalar processor? Mm-hmm. So that's the idea. So let's look at what chaining is. So in chaining, this might be a program on the Cray machine. I'm not using the real assembly language because apparently they just write octal. So here we're going to multiply some things and then we're going to add some things, including using the result of this multiply. So the idea of chaining is that you feed elements one by one into your multiplier, and you get results back, which you store in your registers. And you just forward those right to the add operation. So the add operation takes V1 from the registers, and V3 is forwarded from the computation which just computed it. So this is very much like forwarding in a normal pipeline, or getting something through a reservation buffer in a superscalar processor. But there's something which we can't really do in the superscalar processor, which is happening here. So our instruction is this thing here. V3 is V1 times V2. So what is this value we're forwarding here? Is that the result of the instruction? You're shaking your head. So what is it?
It's the result of the computation of one subsection of it.
Yeah, so this instruction on the Cray machine does up to 64 computations. And we're getting the first result out and sending it right away. We don't wait till we have the whole register. The whole V1 registers V0, 1, 2, up to 63. And if we were doing a traditional approach that looked like a superscalar processor just with big registers, we'd need to get the whole value computed. But we don't wait for that here. They just forward it immediately after it's computed. So these two instructions mostly overlap in their execution, even though we have one adder and one multiplier. And even though they're just two instructions, it's because each of the two instructions does a whole lot of adds and a whole lot of multiplies. And so you get sort of, your performance benefit is from that overlap. So the startup overhead they're talking about is the time to get your first result. So they're assuming that they can't do, and as was not common at the time, something where you overlap every single instruction fully, like we imagine happening in a superscalar processor. So you actually pay that overhead for the latency of the first thing, regardless of dependencies. So with chaining, they wait for, say, a multiplier to complete and then an adder to complete if you're doing multiply then add. You just wait for those to complete and get their first result. And then from that point onward, you have something where you just give it a number every cycle and you get a number out every cycle. That's, in this case, 13 cycles old. And so to do 64 elements, you spend 64 plus 13 cycles, rather than 64 plus 64 plus the time to start the computation and store the result in a register and get it out. So that's where the benefit is, and this is what the startup overhead they're talking about is. Yeah.
So was there one of the significant innovations that they were able to reduce this basically the latency of their ALU to like less than 10 cycles versus before it was like 100 or something? Previous vector processors. Like what I'm asking is, were previous vector processors like, do they have much worse latencies for these type of?
I didn't look up. I'm not actually familiar enough with earlier vector processors to know. But from the description, it sounds like that was true. But the same strategy, that means that they have higher startup overhead. But the rest of the time should still be one per cycle, or one per small number of cycles. Yeah.
So maybe this is just me talking about definitions, but this doesn't really seem like a vector processor as much as a really, really highly pipelined. Like you're not actually doing anything.
So you think...
Like, what is the definition of a vector processor?
Yeah, so you think, I thought that vector operations meant we did multiple things at a time. And we're doing multiple things at a time, but they're not really on a vector. And that's the impression you'd have from modern implementations, which are going to do more than one thing at a time. But that a vector processor is probably not about that. So why do you think... Anyone, why does someone think that this is called a vector processor? Yeah.
It kind of fetches one instruction and then does that same operation the same number of times on like the entire vector.
Yeah, so it's about the interface. That this is a vector processor because this is what our instructions look like. It's about the instruction. So the vector part is we fetch one instruction and we do work on a whole vector based on it. And it's not about actually whether we implement that by doing them actually at the same time. And so there are different strategies for implementing operations on a vector. And the stupidest thing would be to just do an add, then a multiply, so take 13 cycles to do the first element, then start another add after that's finished and do a multiply, and take 13 cycles per. But if that was what you were doing, no one would care about vector processors. So the first benefit we see is that they're taking advantage of pipelining. And they're getting all the efficiency you can get out of pipelining. But a complaint you might have in the modern day is maybe we could get that from our modern techniques, like superscalar processors. So some people mentioned loop unrolling. So loop unrolling gives us a lot of that sort of benefit if we do it right. We get one thing done per cycle with one adder if we have that. So what's the benefit or disadvantage of this approach over what our superscalar processors are doing that we can get with like loop unrolling?
Like the disadvantage of like loop unrolling?
Or the advantages and disadvantages, what's the difference? Like, why would you prefer one over the other?
You mean like in relation to speeding up vector stuff or just speeding up stuff?
Well, that's one of the questions, right? Like, what do we care about? So, well, let's start with that question. So who thinks that if we only care about stuff which works on big arrays of homogeneous data and does operations like this on that data, that vector processors are better? Okay. Yeah. So why? What's one reason they're better? Going to be better for that? Yeah.
I guess, you know, within one operation, there are no data dependencies.
Yeah. So with this vector processor, you know, this operation, the vector processor doesn't need to do anything to figure out, oh, I can just use this value, then this value without any problems. Doesn't need to do register renaming to figure that out. Doesn't need to look for memory dependencies. It just knows that this is an independent operation. So we've gotten rid of a whole lot of logic. We've gotten rid of the question about, is our compiler going to generate code which actually executes quickly? And we're getting the same performance. Any other differences? Any opinions about why you might use a vector processor? So what do people think about code size? How long is this program on a neural processor? If you do loop unrolling correctly.
Well, we go in, it's the size of the, it's a multiple of the size of the.
Okay, so you think that you're to make this faster than a normal processor, you're just going to unroll this loop entirely. You're going to, if it's 64 element vector, you're going to do 64 of these multiplies in 64 x.
Unless you loop, but yeah.
Okay. So if we assume we're doing that, so we've made our program 64 times bigger to get the same performance. Or if you add a loop, in which case, to be at the same performance, we need, say, branch prediction to work correctly. Or else we're going to have to be waiting a bit. We're not going to actually be able to use our adder correctly all the time. So there's advantages, you know, from the perspective of, you know, if this is all you're running, then clearly, you know, there's some things that the vector processor should do better than our superscalar processor running the appropriate program. So there's also some things that the Cray processor did, which were designed to make programming these vector operations more general and easier. Anyone remember some features like that? You know, it was more than just do this sorts of operations. They had some special things. Or let's start out with one of the topics. So a lot of people were surprised that the GPU paper didn't have branching. Really weird to that. The Cray had support for doing things like branching on vectors. Anyone remember anything about what they were talking about for that? This was actually something they cared about. So, yeah.
How it works, I suppose. Or even why they chose that path.
Wait, what mechanism did they have to help people do things like if statements with vectors?
They have like special, I guess, registers.
Okay.
Each vector that stores information about it.
Okay, so they have, it's not quite. So they had metadata, they had something which wasn't just a list of numbers. So the two options we saw for dealing with branches for computing on multiple things in these papers was the GPU option, which is do nothing, not quite, but they essentially said we're not going to do branches. But that's not quite what they said. And the Cray approach was a vector mask register. And what that was is another vector register, but instead of storing numbers, instead of storing 64 numbers, it just stores 64 one-bit values. And the idea is that if you can set the mask in some way, then there are operations which use that mask to decide what to do with a particular element of the vector. One of them was merge. And the way the merge operation works is that if some bit of the mask is set, you get the first thing. If it's not set, you get the second. So this lets you do conditional things if you can set your conditions as the mask values. And they had ways of doing that. So they had an instruction to load an integer into a mask, which maybe would be useful, so you could compute things, you know, what parts of the vector you want. And more importantly, they had an instruction to set the mask based on comparing two vector registers. So they say, compare element 0 and element 0. If it's less than, set the mask bit to 1, otherwise set it to 0. So this lets you use the merge to implement, say, min. So you run that less than operation to set the vector mask. And you have one bit set if v1 is less. And use the merge to actually choose which of the two things you get. And so here we've implemented merge. So min, without having to worry about iterating through the elements of the vector and taking them in of each case. The hardware is going to take care of that for us. And we'll still get the speed ups we got before of having things like chaining later on, if we have some operations after this. Yes?
Is there any benefit if you can't use the instructions that compare the two vectors? Like if you have to loop through and set the bit of each element, is that still faster? Because then you can chain the actual computation, but to set it up, you have to loop through every.
So. Presumably, this set operation will be faster than if you did it manually. Given that I don't think that there's actually a convenient instruction to write to a particular element of a vector register. But otherwise, no. If you can't figure out how to express setting the mask as some set one of these instructions or something like it, you're out of luck. So this is how we can do, say, vector min on the Cray machine. How about on the GPU with that Vertex programming? Could you do this easily? So they don't have a vector mask register. All their vectors are just floating point numbers. Would you have to do, and they don't have branches even, so. So if you read carefully, they actually made sure they had a mechanism to support this sort of thing, but they did it without branches and without having any different types of registers. So what they did, instead of having a special vector mask register that holds bit vectors, is that they just used a register that holds a bunch of floating point numbers, which are 0 or 1. And then you have to construct the merge operation yourself. But you can do that. So they have this set less than instruction, which is designed to produce that sort of mask. But they don't have a special type of register for it. And it just says if it's less than, you set it to 1, otherwise you set it to 0. And you can use this in the same sort of way to implement min. You need a bit of trickiness to figure out how to implement the merge operation. But one approach is you set less than, use that to set, to copy the elements of R1 that you want into R4. Then you use set greater than to get the opposite of that mask, where you subtract 1 from it, and use that to set R5, and then you add R4 and R5 together because they're 0 where you mask things out. And this is the strategy they imagined if you needed conditionals that you would use. Incidentally, it's also the sort of strategy you have to use even if you don't have a vector you want to do it on, because they don't have normal conditional instructions. So even if you only care about R3.x, you still have to do all these instructions. So another issue with vector processors is that sometimes things don't fit in the size that the processor has. So the Cray machine has 64 entry vectors. What happened if you didn't need as much stuff? If you only needed 30 of them? So if we look at the performance, they clearly were doing something pretty good, because this is time per operation, time per element here. And you get, you don't get quite the same time per element, but for the vector operations, you get about the same, you get most of the benefit once you get above like 10 elements. So this means that they were doing less work when you only had 10 than 60. So how did they know to do that? So it was this was one of the registers they had. So there was a vector length register. So along with the vector mask, they had this vector length. So their registers always had 64 values, but they let you set a length, and that could be less. And if you set the length to less, when you were doing the chaining here, this would just go to the length instead of to 64. So you'd actually save time. And this turns out to be pretty important, because a lot of things aren't multiples of 64. So the idea is that if you, say, have a big array and you want to divide it up into chunks of your that fit in your maximum vector length, which is 64 for the Cray machine, that you can divide it up into chunks mostly of the full size, and then you have a little left over. But since you have this vector length register, that's not actually a pain to process. What would you have to do if you didn't have a vector length register and you wanted to handle that?
It's a field of null. You'd have to pad your array.
Okay, so your idea is that if you didn't have this, you'd have to add something here, and then you'd have to make sure that that worked out later on.
Serialize the last little.
Yeah. So having this length makes this a lot easier and avoids, some annoyances that come up in some other systems for programming vectors that you might come across in the future. Extensions on Intel processors don't give you this sort of flexibility. You want to handle the end case, you're going to have to figure that out in a different way. So one approach is padding it, which means that you do the extra work, which on this processor would be a lot slower, in addition to all the work you have to do to add the padding to whatever your input was. So another thing with vectors is, how do these vectors get loaded from memory? So do you think that the Cray machine just has a memory with a 64 by 64 wide bus to get a vector out of? So you're shaking your head. So what do they probably do? So what would the simplest thing to do to load a vector be? Yeah. So to send a request to memory for each element. So that's the simplest thing. And this would mean that you're loading a vector seems pretty slow. Unless our memory is, you know, very well pipelined or something like that. So we'd like to do better than that. And the Cray machine had a simple technique for getting more bandwidth out of their memory. So what are some ways we can get higher bandwidth for memory in a normal processor? Yeah. Yeah. So one issue is that, you know, if we make a request to one memory, we often have to wait and, you know, can't do things while that's happening. So we could have multiple copies of the memory. So we can make a request to one, and if it's busy, that's okay. We have another one, and hopefully we have data we care about in there. And this is called memory banks. And this is very common in vector processors. So you interleave memory. So word 0 of memory is in bank 1, word 1 is in bank 2, and so on. You just spread it out. And the idea is that if you're loading a continuous vector, you're going to request the first element from bank 0, the second element from bank 1, third from bank 2, and so on. And hopefully, even if these banks only support one request at a time, even if they don't have fancy support for multiple outstanding requests, you're going to get a lot more bandwidth for loading a single vector. So for example, if the banks take 5 cycles and you send one request a cycle, you can get a lot, you don't even get full utilization if you have, say, a bunch of them. And this is a lot more efficient than your normal load instructions would be, especially if you didn't do the out of order thing, as was, you know, considered pretty complicated at the time. So this is the optimization that's pretty ubiquitous in these vector processors. But there's going to be, you know, some more complicated things we want to do when loading things from memory. So this is the description of Cray-1's load vector instruction. It transmits vector length worth of words from memory to the elements of a vector, starting at A0 and incrementing by AK, which is where A0 and AK are registers. So you get the first element from A0, second from A0 plus AK, third from A0 plus 2 times AK. So anyone have any guesses as to why they have this sort of instruction? Yeah.
Okay. Depending on how your two-dimensional matrices are loaded, you might want to load in a column vector, in which case you have to stride across the rows.
Yeah, so this is designed to support exactly that pattern, that we have a matrix. And there's this very common pattern where, you know, we don't always want to load a row or a column of a matrix. We sometimes, you know, sometimes want to load a row, sometimes want to load a column. We want to be able to support both. So ideally, we'll lay out our matrix in memory in the order that we most commonly want to load it. So if we usually want to load rows, we'll hopefully put the entire row in order. And if we usually want to load columns, we'll hopefully put the entire column in order. But sometimes you're still going to need to access a column, even though usually you want a row. And classic example is like matrix multiply. One of the matrices you probably want to access with rows more, and the other with columns more. So if we want to load this column here, we're going to access address 0, 4, 8, and so on. So we'll have a stride of 4. Now, how does this look with those memory banks I showed you earlier? So we're accessing address 0, 4, and 8.
Well, they're all in the same bank.
Yeah. And in this picture, where we have four banks, we're accessing 0, 4, and 8. All from the same bank, which is an unfortunate problem that is really hard to avoid. Now, we've set up these memory banks to handle the most common case that where it's continuous in the perfect way, but sometimes we're going to get unlucky. And we're going to end up in this timeline, instead of overlapping all these accesses, waiting a whole bunch of cycles. Unless we can do these loads out of, you know, well, unless we can like do loads for some other vector or something like that. So are there any other sorts of access patterns you'd imagine we want instructions for loading besides this stride? You know, 0, 0 plus k, 0 plus 2k sort of pattern? Any other things you think are going to be common in programs you want to run and vectorize? Okay. Okay, so diagonal, that's so let's think about what diagonal accesses look like. So we want to access 0, 3, 1, 2, 2, 1, let's say. So first question is does that have a regular stride? No. Yeah, so that's not an uncommon sort of thing what to do. And, well, if you want to do that on this processor, it's a lot of work. Because this is, you have to increment 3, then 2, then 1. You could probably arrange those accesses, but it's a lot of work. So more general vector processors support fancier types of load and store instructions for this reason. Which makes the memory system more complicated. Often they even support the most general idea, which is scatter gather, where they will let you do set element to the vector to memory at some address vector of I, where you just have a vector full of a register of addresses. And obviously, you know, so this doesn't give you any regularity about what bank you go to. So this is more complicated logic, but it's the benefit. Well, so what was the benefit with the original case? Why were vector loads reasonably fast? What makes this vector load efficient?
Pipeline.
Yeah, that we're doing lots of work all the time. That we're using all our memory banks simultaneously. We're getting the full bandwidth of our memory, which is pretty hard to do for most, you know, programs you write on the superscalar processor. And you can still get that same benefit from this, that you'll get, you know, the full capability of your memory because the hardware is capable of taking that vector and sending it as to the memory as fast as the memory can handle it. You don't have to worry about keeping track of the state of instructions, having your reorder buffer entry set up, handling load and store conflicts. That's all simplified in this approach. And the bigger issue is that you need some way of getting those values into the vector register anyways. Like, what's the alternative here?
Some function that you call every time you need to get the next drive. Or for each element, you call this function.
So who calls it?
Well,
So you think so if the processor calls it, then we don't have good efficiency, right? If we have scalar code that runs, then we've lost the benefit of our vector processing for what presumably is an important operation. So those are, so we have our general loads and store mechanism there. What was the solution that the GPU had for dealing with memory? So that was a trick question. So the GPU does have memory, but only kind of. Not put that block diagram here. So the GPU has a small array of constants that you can look things up in, and that's it. It also has an instruction memory, which I think holds like 64 instructions or 128 instructions. That's all they have. So their solution to this load and store problem, just like their solution to the branching problem, was, hey, we're not really going to do that. You need to figure out how to work with the inputs we give you in registers and putting things in the output we give you in registers. So their solution was that instead of loading and storing things to do your computation, that you were doing it for a fixed purpose, so the hardware would have specialized things to feed the values to you and get the values out. It wouldn't, you wouldn't be able to choose what happens to those in memory. So, so we have these two examples of sort of parallel processors. So where did each of these machines get their parallelism? So what types of, what mechanisms do we have for the Cray and for the GeForce 3 to do operation, to get, good performance? What's one thing that one of these two processors did to get good performance? Okay, so they both parallelize vector ops. So how did the Cray parallelize vector ops? So we know some things it didn't do. It didn't, for example, have 64 multipliers. So what did it do? What were the techniques they were using to actually do multiple vector ops at the same time? Chaining. So this was the chaining. So they fed results from one vector op to the other before the entire vector was complete. And so this meant that they overlapped different instructions. This is sometimes known as a convoy. So you have a convoy of values going through the functional units. How did the GPU parallelize vector operations? And as a hint, there are at least two things I can remember from the paper that it did. Might be some more. Yeah, so this actually had multiple adders multipliers, etc. So they actually had multiple copies of the adders and multipliers. So that's part of what they did. So there's another thing, which I guess most people, it's mentioned so briefly in the paper for some bizarre reason, but they did multi-threading. So like the Cray machine, their functional units had a latency of more than a cycle. So to hide that, they did multi-threading. Presumably like the Terra machine did multi-threading. They just did round robin between a bunch of vectors to process and their corresponding registers.
So they all have their own registers?
They depend on the input, so I assume so. The paper could be more clear about this, but it's my impression. But this is that old technique we saw before, now being used in this specialized context. And them doing multi-threading explains some of the weird things they're doing. So one of the reasons they didn't do branching, they mentioned, is to keep latency constant. How does constant latency help us with multi-threading? So let's draw our timeline. So we have, let's say, 3 threads. So we start an operation here, and it takes till here. And then during the next cycle, we start an operation here, and it takes to here. During the next cycle, we start an operation here, and it takes to here. Or 2 threads here, and it takes to here, let's say. So if everything takes 2 cycles of latency, then we just start one from each of these 2 threads, one after another. How would this look if the latency was variable?
You wouldn't know when it's beneficial to schedule another thread or not.
Yeah, so here we can just say do thread 1, do thread 2, do thread 1, do thread 2. If we had variable latency, it might be something like would be the thing we'd want to do, but how do we know here what thread to run? We need a bunch of control logic to figure that out. With 2 threads, that's not so bad, actually. All we're checking is one bit, is this thread blocked? Problem is when we go up to like 4, then that actually become, or you know, 100, that actually is going to become pretty complicated. So they just avoided that by having everything take the same amount of time. So they just do round robin between the threads, and they know that since everything takes the same amount of time, that when they get to that thread, there's something for it to do. And if they had memory accesses with a cache, they wouldn't have this. If they had branching, they might have this. But if they had branch prediction, they certainly wouldn't have this. So that's why it simplified things so much. And this is where they're getting a lot of their performance benefits. And in a sense, I like to think that this multi-threading ends up looking a lot like chaining. Because what their functional units basically are doing, you know, ends up looking a lot like this, where since you're running the same program over and over again, you end up passing the value on after the latency passes, just like with chaining. And you're just achieving that with a different mechanism, that you have both vector registers, which hold these four floats, and you have multiple copies of them, and those conceptually are like a big vector. that across the threads. So, are any other sources? Okay, so let's see about other sorts of parallelism we got. Right, so we have chaining, that's our big one. So we also have memory bank overlap. So that's another source of parallelism in the Cray machine. Right. The main one was this chaining. And here we had these two mechanisms. We both had could do multiple operations at the same time. We had multiple functional units, and we're doing multi-threading, which kind of looks like chaining because we're only running one program ever. So we're always doing the same thing, and the program doesn't have branches, so it's always doing the same thing. So we can look at sort of the GPU as basically a specialized vector processor, which happens to have multiple functional units instead of just one. And there are some big specializations here. So probably the biggest one is the input and output, more than even no branches. Like, there's no memory on this machine. That if you want to send things, you have to send them through a very specific way. It's not really designed to give you general purpose answers. Like, if you want the output to go somewhere other than your screen, they don't talk about how you do that. So they also had some special instructions. So what were some things in the instruction set which were really, you know, showed what this processor was used for? Yeah. Yeah, so they had the classic graphics lighting computation, Phong lighting, which you'll learn about if you take a graphics course, as an instruction. They decided that we don't want programmers writing this formula out, we're just gonna do it for them as in hardware, because it's so common on these graphics processors. And this was an example of making the machine more efficient for the case they cared about. They decided that doing that as separate instructions was not worth it because they knew every program would need it, almost every program. And they, in particular, they knew their quote-unquote fixed functionality would need it. Because another goal they had, if you remember, is that they wanted to support fixed functionality as just another program, where fixed functionality was what they were doing before when they weren't programmable. So are there any other things about the instruction set which show you that, which would make it really annoying to use this for general purpose computation? Besides the lack of branches and memory?
They don't have a lot of bitwise.
Yeah, so if you want things that are, bitwise operators, they don't have them. You can't do that. You need to figure out how to do it with additions and multiplications. Anything else like that they're missing? So they just generally don't have integer operations. If you don't want if you don't want 32-bit floating point numbers for everything, there's no other option here. And that's because they care about graphics computations, and they assume in graphics you always prefer floating point. You don't ever want to deal with integer rounding. And they also assume that you don't ever care about more than 32-bit floating point. So in a scientific computation, you'd often want more precision. But in graphics, they didn't care, so they designed their processor around that. And that makes it a lot simpler. So another way that I think it shows it is besides the lighting computation instructions, they have particular other instructions which come up in graphics a lot, which maybe are not so useful versus the instructions they omitted in general purpose computation. Like they have approximate sine and reciprocal and things like that, which, you know, aren't that useful in general purpose computation compared to instructions they're definitely omitting. And maybe a bigger form of specialization is, why do they have four element vectors? Why do they choose four? As a hint, well, yes, so what are the names of the elements of the vectors? It was x, y, z, and w. Yeah, so these are coordinates. So if you're not familiar with graphics, you might not have seen homogeneous coordinates before. But the x, y, and z should make sense to you. So that's a coordinate in 3D space. And this machine is designed to manipulate coordinates in 3D space. And that's why they have four element vectors. The extra one is because it turns out, if you take graphics, you'll learn that it's mathematically convenient to have this extra element in order to represent some transformations in an elegant way. But this is why they have four elements, is because it's about representing coordinates in 3D space. That's why they chose four and not some other length. The Cray machine has 64 element vectors because they recognize that if you want the most speed up, you want something really wide. Even though at the time 64 elements was pretty expensive. But their sizes are just based on their what they're trying to do. And this is, you know, what you're going to see out of a specialized processor like that. So, CUDA, sorry, you wanna?
Yeah, I think, have you guys ever heard of Dan Boothby? I think he's head of NVIDIA, a graphics researcher. Mm-hmm. He was a grad student here. He is credited with writing one of the first papers on math matrix operations.
Is that like
circa
2000?
2005, 4?
Yeah. I'd note that before CUDA, people were doing computations on GPUs. So it used to be, the way you did a computation on GPU is you took the programmable interface for something like this, usually probably the shader for the rasterization parts of the pipeline rather than the vertex parts of the pipeline, I would think. I'm not sure. But you take you write one of these programs, like we saw in this paper, and you'd read the result out of a frame buffer, out of the thing that you might display on the screen. You just render into an off one which you didn't tell the GPU to put to the screen, and you read out your results that way. Obviously, more than a little awkward, but that used to be what you do before CUDA, if you wanted to try to take advantage of this for general purpose computation. But you had a whole bunch of other limitations which make it not amazing for general purpose computation. On the other hand, this processor has a fast floating point multiplier, and often many of them, which maybe even back in 2004, many more than you were likely to have in your CPU. So there was a real benefit to doing that, but the interface is really designed around how do I make graphics fast and easy and convenient to program. So another thing I'd like to mention briefly is, how does the CPU talk to a GPU? Since I know people have an uneven appreciation of I/O from past courses, because some people cover it, some people don't. But I think we should mention briefly something about how I/O works. And this is an example of, you know, how does the CPU actually talk to the GPU? So who has a guess as to what would be a good way to do this? Yeah. So what's PCI Express?
Basically, it interconnects bus
Mm-hmm. So it's an interconnect bus, so it's kind of like the buses we use to talk to memory and to other CPUs in our cache coherency. So that's going to be commonly the same sort of idea we'll use to talk to these external devices. And often the way that will manifest, not always, is that the CPU interface is that the CPU is going to talk to its memory bus, whatever it talks to talk to memory. And the things above that that actually control talking to memory versus other processors after the cache are going to sometimes communicate with hardware. And the interface we'll typically get as a programmer, which is that there are some memory locations that the GPU or some controller in front of the GPU listen for and does something special with. So the programming interface is you do a memory read and write, and that actually sends a message to the GPU or its controller or some piece of hardware that's not the processor, rather than actually accessing a memory location. And often you'll hear, when Tayul talking about hardware, accessing these memory locations being called as like hardware registers. So people might say like an Ethernet card has registers that the OS accesses. This is what they mean. That you send something on to what you think is memory, and that actually ends up going on something like PCI Express or to this device, and that device interprets it as a command. So a problem with this is that to send each thing, we can only send what fits in the memory read and write, and we have to wait for that to happen. This is not going to use cache because obviously we're not going to cache a valid command. So a common optimization that is ubiquitous in modern hardware is something called direct memory access. So it will often turn out that we'll have our CPU and our GPU and our Ethernet car net interface and so on all connected to the memory bus. So they can access memory themselves, usually through some intermediary. We're not going to talk about like all the components involved, but there's some way that they can access memory without getting the processor involved. So a common interface for communicating with devices, if you have something large to send, is that the CPU can write a whole bunch of values to memory, say a list of vertices to draw. Then it can send a command to the device by writing to a pretend memory location with that memory address. And then the device can read those values that the CPU wrote earlier directly from memory. And while that's happening, the CPU does not need to be involved. It doesn't need to respond to messages, handing them each vertex one at a time. And so this is commonly what you'll see used for devices of all sorts to communicate with the CPU. So I'm mentioning here in the context of GPUs, but this is also how we talk to hard drive controllers, and network interfaces and lots of other devices. So before we finish up, any last questions, comments for the day?
I guess I don't really understand much about graphics. I've never taken a graphics course, but if you know, you write like some kind of piece of software that has a lot of intense graphics calculations that are involved.
Yeah.
Because obviously when you start running that program, it's going to run on your CPU. How does the GPU like get everything that it needs? Is that just this regular communication here, or?
It's these types of communication patterns. And to get efficiency, you want to, you know, have not be, you know, waiting to send things all the time. And the difficulty of that is part of the motivation for the paper we saw is that they want to move that to the GPU, so you send stuff to the GPU once and do most of the calculations there without needing to communicate back and forth. And but
when the GPU like has a calculation complete, then it sends it back.
Not in the paper, but later on we will. So next week, so Jack, who will be guest lecturing next week to tell you all about CUDA and things like that and how modern GPUs work. And this is going to actually be a big issue, is how do you send things back and forth? How fast is it? And it still is an issue. And it's also an issue if you're doing normal graphics, that you can't just, like, if you can generate pictures on a screen, you know, it's not enough to have them computed in your cache. You actually need to get them to the graphics card.
The nice thing is that, like, you know, oftentimes your screen is plugged into the graphics card. So the GPU doesn't have to go all the way back to the CPU. It's kind of one-directional.
Yeah. So for graphics, yeah, it's usually one-directional, which helps a lot.
For GPU, you want, like, both sides.
So that's what I have.